Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Hey, have you thought about canning, but maybe you're a little intimidated by it? Our guest today can help you with getting started. I had Christina Ward with us. She's a master food preserver from Milwaukee County and an award-winning writer and editor. She's the author of the book Preservation, The Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. So, what would you like to know about canning or maybe fermenting? Questions about using maybe the Instant Pot for canning? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Christina Ward, in our Milwaukee studios, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, everyone.
How do you become a master food preserver?
Well, the Master Food Preserver program is a 100-plus-year-old program that is part of actually the university extension program across the country, part of the land-grant universities. And it's a specialized program of both training and practicals, so you become a scientifically based expert for your community. And it's a volunteer role, and the idea is that you get the latest and greatest information and you share it with your community to make sure that everyone is doing any type of food preparation, preservation safely.
That was likened it to the Master Gardener program, for example.
It's similar. It's a little bit more intensive.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because there's a lot of understanding about pathologies of microbiology and what makes you sick.
How did you get interested?
I grew up in Milwaukee, but spent all my summers on my grandmother's farm in Jackson County near Black River Falls. And she had a very kind of primitive farm, even for the 70s. And I was very interested in the work that she was doing, and she was putting up food for the winter. And that's really what got me started, and it's something I've always followed. And when I had the opportunity in the mid-2000s to really kind of try to reinvigorate the Master Food Preserver program here in Milwaukee County, I took it and ran with it and started teaching classes here, because Milwaukee, as well as you're seeing it in Madison and other cities, has this great resurgence in urban agriculture, from personal victory gardens to using vacant lands to start growing more fruits and vegetables. And so after you grow all that stuff, you've got to do something with it.
You do indeed. And I grew up on a farm, and my mother and my grandmother both canned and froze and preserved. And so I grew up with it, too. And it was always a lot of fun and great in the middle of winter to have those canned tomatoes or whatever to have to eat.
It's that reminder. It tastes like summer. And it's also that in the middle of February, a reminder that as cold as you might be, summer will come again.
Is one a method better than another in your mind when it comes to preserving food?
It's really about, I always, in classes, I teach people to think about it in a reverse. How do you want to use the product, and what are your capabilities? And so if you are maybe just one or two people, you don't have to put up, say, you know, 5 dozen jars of tomatoes. Maybe freezing a few quarts of tomatoes would be enough for you to get through the winter. Or say if you're in a rural area where, as it's been happening this summer, where your electricity goes in and out, then you may want to consider doing hot water bath canning of sauce, because your family eats a lot of, say, tomato sauce. Or maybe pressure canning just whole tomatoes, because you're a good and versatile cook and you just want those tomatoes to get started with for all your recipes. So it's really about how do you enjoy eating that food. And once you determine how you want to eat the food, the best way to preserve it, it comes as a secondary.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own circumstances. I always loved I had a recipe for a V8 type tomato juice. So I'd raised a lot of tomatoes every year, and I'd can 50 quarts. And so I had one quart a week for the year And figuring in 2 weeks for vacation when I wouldn't be around.
And that's the best way to do it. Now, that recipe is a really handy recipe. It tastes great. It is available on the Wisconsin Extension, so the University of Wisconsin Extension site, as the kind of quote-unquote V8 juice. And so those recipes can be downloaded for free. They're PDFs, or if you want a printed booklet, it's just a couple dollars to send away to the university. But there's a lot of those recipes available for free for people. Even though I wrote a book, you could still get that information for free. But you want to do it on only an accredited site, and that means either from the University of Wisconsin or from the Center for Home Food Preservation. And those are the best sources for that information.
Give you a chance to join in here. Give a call with your questions or maybe your experiences with preserving food. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Grant emailed that he's tried to freeze sweet corn using a few methods, but none gave him the results he was after. What's the best method for preserving and or freezing corn that has been removed from the cob?
Corn can be a little tricky sometimes because of the sugars. And the sugars will break down in the freezing process, and that's to be expected. A lot of times what we do with vegetables, especially that are higher in sugar, is blanching. And so that's just so whether you do it on the cob or can take it off and then try to blanch it quickly is just like a 1 minute in the boil and then, you know, pull it off, let it cool, and then pack it and freeze it. The second thing you want to do is then remove as much air as possible. I know some of the modern like food saver systems have that vacuum seal. So yeah, if you can get a vacuum seal, that's great. But any way you can to remove the air from the storage container before you put it in the freezer is going to help get high quality frozen corn. And that works for most every fruit and vegetable. So the less air, the better quality.
Yeah, my mother froze the corn. I think she blanched it, and then she'd take all of the kernels off the cob, and then she'd pack the bag very tightly, And man, I always thought it tasted just like it was coming off the cob to the end.
Yeah, your mom did it the exact right way.
Yeah, it was always a great treat in the wintertime. Let's talk about canning. What's the basis for this type, or what are the basics for this type of preserving?
The idea behind canning, and there's two types of canning. You'll hear hot water bath canning, and that's what you may remember is just putting jars in a big pot of boiling water, or pressure canning. There are two tools that we use to preserve the food, and they're doing something similar to different degrees. And what you're doing is you're, one, raising the temperature inside the jar of the food to make sure that you're killing any pathogens. And then that slight change with a hot water bath canner of the pressure pushes out any of the actually oxygen air that may have some germs in it and leaves deoxygenated air, so dead air. That becomes then kind of a sterile environment. With the pressure canner, it's raising the temperature even more to beyond what you can do with just boiling water because of the pressurization, and that obliterates any kind of pathogen whatsoever. And the difference is when you're using a hot water bath canner, that's for things that are considered higher in acid. So pickled things, sauces, salsas, jams, jellies, those are considered high in acid. But if you're doing, say, just green beans in water, that's something that needs that additional oomph, that power of a pressure canner.
And even tomatoes, I always put some lemon juice or something in with it too, because they're not as acidic as they used to be.
They're not. With the hybridization, they don't have as much acid. The acid in the tomato also varies a little bit from, you know, one day to the next, whether you're growing them or you're getting from the farmer's market, and as well as a lot of the heirloom tomatoes actually are lesser in acid. So it's always the recommendation, and again, depends on the exact recipe, is to acidify your tomatoes or use a pressure canner. It's one of those fruits that you could use in either or situation.
You know, I got an Instant Pot for Christmas, and I've used it quite a few times. I haven't used it for canning. I expect it would be fine for canning.
Actually, it is not fine for
it
canning.
Isn't? Oh,
no.
My goodness.
That's one of the questions we get a lot. The key with a pressure canner when you're using, and again, that technology hasn't changed much from the 1700s, is by having it on the heated surface, you know, the stove, whether it's an electric or a gas flame, and having the pressure, you know, that you can control that pressure and heat. That is the key. When it's an Instant Pot, when it's that all that computerized stuff, is there's no way to really control the amount of pressure in that pot. And therefore, it's just not considered safe. Now, there may be a time when the technology changes and that the University at Madison, which specializes in testing all of the food preservation equipment, maybe there might be a time in the future where the machines become more controllable and would be determined to be safe. But at this point in time, they are not really safe for using for actual canning.
Well, that's kind of a bummer. I was thinking, oh, God, I can do a little canning yet this fall with my Instant Pot.
And some of the challenge is that some of those Instant Pots will have like a button on it that says canning. But yeah, don't listen to the pot. Listen to the university.
Oh, my goodness. Talking with Christina Ward today from our Milwaukee studio. She's Master Food Preserver for Milwaukee County, award-winning writer and editor. It's great to have her talking with us today about preserving the harvest. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking preserving the harvest today with our very own master food preserver for Milwaukee County, Christina Ward. Great to have her with us, and thank you for joining in. Call us at 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And Christina, let's take some calls. David in Chilton, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question is how to store and basically preserve or keep potatoes, and especially sweet potatoes. I'd like to know a little more about the curing process, especially when you don't want to spray anything on them to prevent sprouting, and you don't have a big cooler or humidity control like a lot of the large producers do. What can we do as home consumers?
Okay.
For sweet potatoes, and I'm assuming that, you know, you're not going to can them, so we'll talk about canning for just a second. As a home consumer, you could peel them, cut them into small, like 1-inch chunks, and pressure can them. That is one way to preserve it. But you can also use some very old technology of root cellaring, you know, if you think back to farm life, everyone had a root cellar, whether that was something that was dug into your dirt basement, or some folks had them actually outside of the actual house. But a lot of sweet potatoes, those type of vegetables, can be sand stored. And so in a root cellar where it's temperature consistent, and that's why that below ground keeps temperatures very consistent, and using very clean sand in a contained area in a small bin. I've seen folks do it with like a kid's wading pool and fill it with clean sand, and you can put the sweet potatoes in there, and you know they'll keep without sprouting for a longer time than say if you just kept them in a bin in the kitchen.
So another way to do it, David. Thank you very much for calling. Connie in Portage, your turn.
Yes, morning. I was wondering, do you not suggest open kettles for tomatoes anymore?
Open kettle isn't really, it's an old term, and to listeners, we'll talk about what it is. Open kettle is a very old term where you're just essentially making the jam or the preserve, pouring it in a jar, and then putting the lid on it. That is not safe. Again, food preservation is science-based, and what was safe maybe 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and even 100 years ago isn't safe now. We know more about the science. And so even for something where jams, we recommend highly using a two-part lid and doing a hot water bath. and for at least, you know, depending on the recipe, 5 to 7 minutes. What that also means isn't good anymore is a lot of times going with open kettle was wax, and you'll still see it in the grocery stores. Wax is not safe. So how grandma did it, where you just poured like hot jelly into a jar and then poured wax on it, that is no good. You're not actually doing the thing where you're changing the pressure enough to actually push the oxygenated air out. And that's a critical step to making it shelf stable and safe.
And you know what? Jill Nadeau, our producer, she posted a photo online of some jelly, I think, and she had them stored upside down. It was a photo of some being stored upside down, and that's not correct, is it?
That is not correct. You know, again, food preservation, especially, there's a great joy. We have such fond memories of making these things with, say, a mom, a grandma, and aunts, and it's a very community-oriented process. And so we remember the old ways, and again, but they're not necessarily safe. So where that comes from is back to the open kettle. If you were pouring wax on the top of a jelly, and after the initial, as it starts to harden, then people would turn their jars upside down with this thought that that would make a seal. Well, one, that's incorrect. And two, that habit of just turning jars upside down stayed with people, even as they changed to two-part lids. So if you ask a lot of folks why they're turning their jars upside down, they're like, I don't know. That's the way my mom did it. So stop turning your jars upside down.
Oh, man. Betty in Trempealeau County. On to you now. Hi, Betty.
Hi. When I used to freeze sweet corn, I always blanched it, and then the kernels would be so soggy when I unfroze it to eat. So I heard somewhere, and I started doing this, I would just throw my sweet corn with the husks on into the freezer, and the leaves were so tight on it, I thought that was a better seal. When I take it out in December and January, it's almost like summer, and then the kernels are not soggy. Is this dangerous, or is there a problem with doing this?
As long as you're cooking the actual kernels of corn afterwards, then it's not so much an issue. My only concern, just, and it's a, you know, low level, would be that when you're freezing the outer leaves, you may have trapped in some, you know, some dirt or some germs in there. But the freezing process most likely kills everything. So, you know, if it works for you, then,
and you have a big enough freezer.
Exactly. Then that's fine. A lot of folks, again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little earlier, is think about how you want to eat the food and what your best preferred method of eating it is, and then freeze it, preserve it, how you get to that end result. So if doing that whole cob with the greens still on works for you, there's no specific harm in doing it that way.
There you go, Betty. Thank you. Wanda in Orfordville, your turn now.
Hey, let's talk about dehydrating.
Sure.
I'm a new fan of my dehydrator. I bought it because I enjoy getting apple crop in that I peel and corn, slice the apples and dry them. They take up a lot less space for storage, and they're delicious just as they are. I give them to everyone at Christmas time. And I further have done my herb leaves. I've got sage and basil and even some chives, all that kind of stuff. And it takes up very little room, so why do I want to buy it dried from the store? I can do it at home. I'm thinking about some other things that I might do. I haven't tried sliced carrots or potatoes that turn black, but I'm wondering how many more things I could do in the dehydrator. Takes very little energy, takes a lot less space to store, and works fine.
All right, Mary. Thank you very much for calling, Wanda. Appreciate it. What do you think, Christina?
I'm a big fan of dehydrating. You know, and if that's your preferred method, if you love eating banana chips or apple chips, and if your living situation, say, you know, you're living in a remote cabin for the summer, dehydration is a great way to store the food, and because then all it requires is rehydration. One suggestion I'd make for Wanda, if she's looking to explore some of the new things that she could do with it, is to start thinking about, you could make dehydrated soup stock mixes. So essentially, all of the vegetables that you would use, like, say, the mirepoix, which is like celery, onion, carrot, and chop in little pieces. And you could do that, put that in your dehydrator, dehydrate it, and, you know, seal store it. When you dehydrate, you have to seal it to make sure that no air gets back in. Because if air gets back in, moisture gets back in, it rehydrates, and then it could, you know, begin to mold and grow pathogens. But, you know, keep the air out. But those dried soup mixes are a really great way to kind of mix up some of the vegetables. The other thing, of course, you can use your dehydrator for is for making jerky. So whether beef jerky, turkey jerky, venison jerky. So dehydrated meats are quite good in the dehydrator as well.
Done a lot of venison jerky on my dehydrator, and it's wonderful.
It is. And as a tool, what you're doing, again, the idea of food preservation is, it's called, in science, it's called hurdle technology. We want to change the environment. We're erecting hurdles against the germs to make our food last longer. And so with dehydration, what you're doing is you're taking away the moisture. So using a low level of heat to accelerate the evaporation, you take away the moisture, and therefore the food lasts longer.
And Wanda, thank you so much for calling. Keep up with your dehydrating for sure. Rosemary in Frankfort, Illinois. On to you now. Hi, Rosemary.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a little response to the gentleman and also the lady who had called about having soggy vegetables after you blanch them.
Yep.
And I do have a vacuum sealer, and I've always used it, especially for my asparagus in the spring, and love the asparagus, but I always got soggy, just, you know, moisture-laden asparagus, even when freezing them individually on sheets after blanching them. And I found a solution to the problem, and it's so simple. I'm sorry I didn't think of it myself. I should have. Use your vacuum sealer with the raw vegetables, seal them completely, and blanch them in the bag, cool them, and put them in the freezer, and they're wonderful. They're not soggy. They have only their own vegetable juices that are in there.
Interesting.
You know, that's a great idea. And it would go to the food trend if you're familiar with, like, sous vide cooking.
Yeah.
Right. And that's essentially what you're doing. You're doing a sous vide and then freezing it. A good idea. That'll work great. If you've got that kind of vacuum sealer, the food sealer, that you can get all the oxygen out, seal it up, and just drop it in the pot for just a moment, that works great. The other thing to talk about is, a lot of times if people don't have that sealer, they're still getting the mushy vegetables with blanching, is a lot of folks do it for too long. When you're supposed to blanch for just like a minute, that's really what they mean. And between the futzing of getting them in the boiling water and out of the boiling water, it usually ends up in the water more. So if you can act a little faster, and also remember that you need to stop that blanching process by taking them out of the boiling water and putting them in ice water right away to kind of arrest that process.
Very good points. And Rosemary, thank you. Nick in Elroy, it's your turn.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of shredding some cabbage, making some sauerkraut, but in another day, I'm going to be doing a lot of tomatoes. And one of the things is, after we get them out of the pressure cooker can, I always see this big separation of the water and the tomatoes. How can I minimize that, okay, when I'm packing?
That is totally normal. I mean, so you're not really going to minimize it as much. Really, that is totally normal. That's actually, you're doing it right. The water that's coming out of the tomato is what you're seeing towards the bottom, and it gets a little heavier. That's where you get the separation. And it's fine. There's really no way to minimize it.
So just shake it up before you use it.
Shake it up before you use it.
There you go, Nick. Thank you. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your food preserving questions or maybe your own experience. We always love to hear people's experiences as well. Karen emailed to ask if you could talk about preserving garlic.
Garlic, sure. Garlic, I find the two most bestest ways to do it for home cooks is to either dehydrate it, and you can dehydrate it and into little, you know, chunks, or into make it into a powder, make your own garlic powder, or pickle it. I think pickled garlic is really fun, and you could pickle it and keep it in the fridge, or you could pickle it and then can it and keep it for a longer time. One of the benefits to doing a pickled garlic is it actually mellows out the garlic taste. And so you have garlic, but not such a potency because of some of the chemical reactions that are happening. One of the challenges of pickling garlic, though, is you want to make sure you're doing that only with fresh garlic. Otherwise, you'll sometimes get a chemical released, an odd chemical reaction. And this will also happen with pickles. If you put garlic in your pickled cucumbers, older garlic has a type of enzyme in it that turns blue. So you'll look at everything looks great, and then the next day or so you'll see this like little blue thing in the bottom of your jar. That means you had kind of old garlic or garlic with a surfeit, too much of that type of enzyme. But otherwise, it doesn't poison your garlic. It won't poison you. But try pickling garlic. It's really good.
And Eileen in West Salem emailed. She saw a Ball brand electric canning pot at her area farm supply store. It would eliminate using the range top, priced at about $120. Are you familiar with this appliance, and is it effective for boiling bath canning?
Now, it is. Now, the Ball Company has come out with that, and that's a little different than an Instant Pot, which is an electric pressure cooker. And so the Instant Pot cannot be used for pressure canning in lieu of an actual pressure canner. But this new gadget from the Ball Company is, and again, like a lot of gadgets, I think sometimes it's just a little too expensive and overly futzy. But essentially what you do is you put your sugar, you add pectin, lemon juice, and your mashed fruit together. You put it in the jars in this machine, and it holds, I think, 4 jars. And then you put the lids on, and you put the lid on the machine, and it both cooks and then processes for the few minutes after your jam. But it only works for jam and jelly. So again, a $14 kettle that you can boil stuff with versus a $100 machine for making 4 jars of jam. I'm not sure. I'm going to go with the.
You can get
pot.
More in the kettles too.
You can. Yes. So, but yeah, it's an okay thing. Again, it's a little bit like I tend to be on the frugal side, and so a specialized machine like that, it just seems a little unnecessary.
Carol in Minocqua, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes, I have a couple of questions. One is, should the rings remain on when putting the jars in storage? And I know you had mentioned not to store them upside down, but my husband loves to do that. Can you explain why that's not a good idea? Thank you.
I'm happy to answer both questions. So the rings or the bands on a canning jar serve two purposes only, and that's to keep the lid, the flat part, on the jar during processing, and that's both hot water processing or pressure canning. And then it acts as kind of a cushion if you're going to move those jars around to a different location. Other than that, the bands, those rings, should be taken off. The reason is a couple. They can be reused, so you want to reuse those. Secondly, they're made of really cheap metal. And in the water processing, both pressure canning and the hot water bath, is the water will get between the lid and the jar. And if you leave them on, they'll begin to rust. And they get rust and stuck on the jar, and that's no good. And then to your second question, why you shouldn't store them upside down. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but it can, is if you turn it upside down, especially before that 24-hour sealing period, because again, a jar can take up to 24 hours to properly seal, you may actually prevent the jar from sealing. And so all your hard work goes to waste because you just turned it upside down.
Oh. So there you have it, Carol. Thanks. And so if you waited 24 hours, could you then turn it upside down?
No, I would prefer you didn't.
Okay.
And mostly because that's sometimes, you know, the pressure of enough, you know, and again, it's not going to happen every time, but it could. The pressure is enough. It could, you know, break the seal on the jar. And then if that seal breaks, then you've got a mess because everything is, you know, down towards the opening.
Terry in Madison. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious as whether or not I can freeze beets in a vacuum pack.
Beets? Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely, you can. I would definitely, you know, peel them. So you want to, you know, don't do it like a whole beet. I would definitely peel them and either slice them or do chunks. They're gonna freeze better quality for you that way than say a whole beet, unless they're smaller.
And do you do anything to the beets?
Blanching is always a great idea, you know, especially for root vegetables. Blanching for just a minute or two. What it does is that prevents the enzymatic decay, and it keeps that, it kind of essentially like freezes, you know, in place. It just holds all the nutrients in that vegetable and keeps it really the color good, and you get a higher quality product when you finally go to use it.
Let's go to Victor in Washington Island next. Hi, Victor.
Hello. So I do a lot of salmon fishing, and I preserve my salmon by canning, also smoking. Now, I keep reading about cold smoking. I do a heat smoke where I get my fish for the first, you know, I brine them for 12 hours in a salt bath, and then I smoke them under a heavy smoke for about 3 hours at about 150 to 170, and then I bring it up from 180 to 200 for about an hour, and then I bring it back down and then wait an hour, and then I remove it from the smoker. It's a homemade smoker. It seems to be working, but do you see any issues with doing a heat smoke like that over a cold smoke?
No, I prefer, or for safety reasons, that the methodology that you're using, the heat smoke. Again, you're raising the temperature of the actual fish enough, especially with wild caught fish, is you know, you've got a higher rate of potentially for parasites. And so by raising that temperature up in that smoke, it's up to over 200, you're doing yourself a favor hopefully, you know, you've got a better chance of removing any kind of pathogens. Whereas a constant cold smoke where the temperature is much lower is you might have some remaining pathogens. I would definitely recommend that you keep on the path you're doing. The University of Washington State, as well as the University of Alaska, are two great resources. If you go to their websites and for their extension offices, they have the state-of-the-art information on preserving fish. And so it'll either reaffirm what you're doing already and might give you some new ideas. But definitely, I think you're doing it exactly the right way.
Way to go, Victor. Thank you for calling. Christina in Glenwood City. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you.
Sure. What can Yeah, go ahead.
Christina, I heard you on WPR when your book came out, and I got it immediately. I am into fermenting, and I absolutely love your fermented granola recipe. I was surprised you could ferment granola. But now I'm avoiding grain. So I'm wondering if I can pulse my nuts and seeds and then proceed with the recipe without the oatmeal.
Yes, absolutely you can.
Oh, terrific.
Absolutely. And you could use sometimes like what's referred to sometimes as ancient like grains that aren't necessarily have the same kind of, say, celiac response. You could substitute those altogether. I have a friend in New York who's doing amazing fermentation work using essentially nut pastes and fermenting, like making misos, nut-based misos, and just really extraordinary stuff. So, yes, absolutely. Substitute away and keep on fermenting.
Doug and Debbie emailed to ask if you could talk about making and preserving sauerkraut.
Oh, sauerkraut, so much fun. It's such a great Wisconsin item. We have such a great history for that. So sauerkraut is one of the most basic ferments ever. It's really just cabbage, and that could be white cabbage, red cabbage, green. The white cabbage is green cabbage. It's usually referred to as white cabbage. And salt. And it's really about keeping those ratios intact. And what happens is the salt begins to leach out the moisture of the cabbage and then acts as essentially a magnet for the lactobacillus bacteria. Once the lactobacillus moves in, that's the fermentation process, and produces as essentially its poop, for lack of a better word, it produces lactic acid and raises the acidity, and that's what preserves the cabbage, the sour, and becomes sauerkraut and gives it the flavor. So that's the basics of how you do it. But within that, there's a lot of room for adding different flavors. Traditionally, like caraway seeds, some people will put in a couple like slices of apple for sweetness. So once you have your sauerkraut, it's just fermented, room temperature. But afterwards, you have a couple choices. You can put your sauerkraut when it hits peak kraut into the refrigerator. When you put it in the refrigerator, it doesn't stop that fermentation process, but it slows it down. The benefit of that is that actually lactobacillus is still living, and then you get the kind of nutritional gut health benefits. There are other ways to preserve it. You can can it. You can put it in a jar and can it. And if you've been to, say, the grocery store and you've seen like a canned or jar of sauerkraut, that's what you're getting. It still tastes good, but you're not getting the active probiotic effect. The same thing, you can also freeze it, but again, that also kills the bacteria.
Can you, Jennifer wonders if you could freeze bell peppers and broccoli.
You can. Bell peppers, again, do well with a little bit of blanching. Real quick, they get a little softer, but maybe cut them in strips or chunks. And again, a quick blanch, throw them in a safe Ziploc or vacuum bags work better than, say, a container, because you can get more of the oxygen, more of the air out, and so you get a better quality product. Broccoli, you have to be a little bit more careful with, blanch a little bit longer, and you want to make sure it's really clean, because with all the florets, same thing goes with cauliflower, is dirt gets trapped in there. So you want to make sure it's really clean, blanch it for just maybe 2 to 3 minutes, a little bit longer, and then immerse it in the cold water, and then again, in a plastic freezer bag or a vacuum sealer, and in the freezer it goes, and you end up with really, really good frozen vegetables.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Christina. I hope you can come back and be with us again. It was really good.
I'd love to, Larry. I love talking about how to do this safely, because our growing season is so short. We've got such a short time to enjoy our fruits and vegetables. So any way we can make that last longer, I'm in favor of.
Well, we will have you back then, since you're willing to do that. Thank you so much for
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. Christina Ward from our Milwaukee studios, a master food preserver for Milwaukee County, award-winning writer and editor. Her book is titled Preservation, The Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. So it was really fun talking with her. And we will have her back and talk with her again. Coming up, our buildings, roads, and activities can cause a lot of problems for wildlife, especially during migration of some of our wild animals. We'll be talking about that next here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.